Hello and welcome to the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we're here today to talk about macronutrients and the subcategory of sugar and the structure and function. And sugar is a hot topic. It's in the news. It's something your clients are going to be asking you all the time about. And the kinds of things they may be saying to you are, I crave sugar. I feel like I need a sugar fix after I eat a meal, or I heard that sugar is bad for me. Is all sugar bad for me? Why is sugar bad for me? Doesn't my body need sugar? And on and on and on. And so we're going to clarify sugar today, what it is, what it does in the body, what its structure looks like biochemically, how it works, what are the different types of sugar molecules that you'll be looking at, and are there alternatives to sugar? Is there a way for you to have your client be able to enjoy the sweet taste without the negative side effects? Well, let's just begin and find out. Before we get right into the meat of our conversation, I just want to remind you that everything we share is information, not medical advice, not intended to replace the medical advice of a qualified practitioner, not intended as diagnosis, not intended as treatment, and especially if you're working with somebody who's on medication or is working with a medical practitioner in some form or another, you need to make sure that they're aware that they need to bounce these ideas off their practitioner before they jump right in and start. Within the macronutrients module, we've been looking at the big guys, right? The things that the body needs in large amounts. Primary is water. That's what we need in the largest amount. And then we've got our macronutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrates that we just derive from food. So within the structure of carbohydrates, we've looked at a number of things so far, and now we're going to hone in and go deep on the concept of sugar. So let's review. We've looked at this in the main carbohydrate module, but I know that it requires a little bit of more detail and reminders. We all need to reminder. So review. Sugar on a molecular level, there's three types of sugars that we look at: monosaccharides, disaccharides, and oligosaccharides. Monosaccharides, composed of one basic core sugar molecule, one glucose or fructose or galactose, and we'll look at those. Disaccharides contain two bonded together, and there's a bond between them that needs to be broken down enzymatically in the body to monosaccharide. And then oligosaccharides, which are short chains, usually anywhere from 3 to 9 sugar molecules bonded together, and we'll look again at those in more detail. And then the other type of carbohydrate we looked at was the polysaccharides, which are long chains, which is mostly your starches. So why we need sugar? Sugar is the core of energy production. Each and every mitochondria in the body takes in sugar, glucose generally, and converts it into ATP. So it's really the energy requirements that we have in the body. Where does it come from in the diet? Well, for some people, it comes from processed sugar, table sugar, which is also usually called sucrose. It comes from processed foods, candies, cakes, pies, etc. It comes from fruit, and it can come from some grains. So what affects the rate of absorption and uptake into cells? And we'll go into more detail about this, but the presence of fiber and fat and protein along with the sugar determines how quickly it's going to get into the cells, and also the type of sugar that it is and where it's coming from. And it relies somewhat on the person's digestive capabilities. How's sugar converted into energy? Pop, goes the weasel. It goes into the cell, into the mitochondria. So first it has to go from the mouth and down into the digestive tract, has to be broken down into its single monosaccharides, gets absorbed through the lining of the gut. And then once inside the bloodstream, it has to attach onto insulin, which is the hormone that helps transport it across the cell walls, gets into the cell, and then it's transported into the mitochondria. And in the mitochondria, it's combined with oxygen and a bunch of nutrients in what's called the Krebs cycle, which we've studied, and it gets converted into energy in the form of ATP. So that's a little bit of a nutshell about that. What's needed for sugar to be efficiently utilized? Well, in order to go through the Krebs cycle, you need to have a good supply of oxygen. So in somebody who is having breathing problems, lung problems, is very acid rather than alkaline, has shortness of breath, they're not going to have as much or as saturated a blood with oxygen. That's going to affect it. We also need a number of amino acids to get through the Krebs cycle, and B vitamins and minerals. So for a review of that, I'd recommend that you go to our metabolism, cellular metabolism module, and really hone in on and bone up on that. The negative effects of simple sugars. Well, we're going to go into a lot more detail here, but the negative effects of simple sugars are, number one, they cause a decrease in immune response. In other words, what they'll do is cause a decrease in macrophages, which are white blood cells that help counter disease. They instigate or accelerate, let's just say, the rate of growth of cancer, because cancer cells have a lot of glucose receptors and a lot of insulin receptors on them, and so it's much easier to get sugars into the cancer cells than it is to get it into the good cells. Dental decay, throwing off the acid-alkaline balance, and a number of other things. And then what are alternatives for to sugar for satisfying the sweet tooth, and we'll go through a number of those. So let's just look at the molecular level of sugar. These are the three disaccharides, and we started with the disaccharides, so you can see the monosaccharides chained together. So sucrose, which is the common sugar that people eat as table sugar. I remember growing up and having the big sugar bowl, and we could go in any time we wanted to and just take a spoonful of sugar. That's sucrose generally, and the sucrose is composed of one fructose and one glucose. If you look at the picture, what you'll see is the hexagonal shape, the one with six atoms around, that is your glucose, and the pentagonal, which is five, that's your fructose. Now, fructose still has six carbons, just like glucose. They're actually the same molecular formula. They're just a different structure. So it's very important, and it's very interesting to note how in biochemistry, just a slight change in either the shape or the composition of particular molecules can make a completely different action in the body. The second sugar, and get back to sucrose, the enzyme that's required to break the bond in between the two molecules, which would be glucose and fructose, is actually called sucrase. And most enzymes have the ending ASE, as we've been learning. Lactose is milk sugar. Lactose is composed of two sugars. One is galactose, and the other one is glucose. And the very, very similar, the way that galactose and glucose look, it's just there's a little bit of a flipping of one side. It's almost like one is the other, but slightly flipped on its end. The enzyme, which I'm sure you've heard about in a lot of conditions related to bloating and gas and diarrhea, is lactase. And the lactase enzyme is required to break apart the lactose and the glucose. And when we have these disaccharides going down into the lower part of the intestine because of the lack of the enzymes to break them down, we get a lot of negative byproducts of fermentation and putrefaction of these sugars by the gut bacteria. And then finally, we've got maltose. And maltose is two glucoses chained together. The enzyme that breaks them down apart is, not surprisingly, maltase. So now let's look in more detail at those monosaccharides that we just talked about. We've got glucose, fructose, and galactose. There's glucose. It's got the six carbons. There's an outer ring of six atoms. Five of them are carbon, and one of them is oxygen. We have fructose, which is a five-sided structure, a pentagon, and it's got four carbons around there and an oxygen, and then the other two carbons are in the outer, hanging off as side chains off one of the central core. And then galactose looks very, very, very similar to glucose, but if you look, you'll see that the upper left-hand hydrogen on the glucose is now an oxygen combined with hydrogen. And on the opposite side, you'll see that it's flipped the other way. So basically, in the galactose, the OHs are on the topmost part and the hydrogens are down at the bottommost part. And in the glucose, it's opposite. Very tiny changes, and you don't need to memorize this. It would be great if you could recognize these, but it is confusing. But know that just a tiny, tiny little bit of change in the molecular structure can make a huge change in the way that that molecule functions in the body. So let's look more detail at glucose. Glucose is transported across the intestinal brush border. That's the epithelial lining of the intestine, the small intestine, in particular the jejunum, the part of the small intestine that does the absorption. And there's a transporter that's dependent on sodium, and it's called S-GLUT1. And so in order to have the glucose being transported, obviously there's enough, you need to have enough of the sodium, which means that things that deplete sodium can have an effect on the transport. There's a really nice little write-up about that, and you're welcome to look at it if you want to know more detail about how that transporter works. But glucose then, once it's transported across the intestinal lining, gets into the bloodstream. You're not home free yet, right? You've got to get that glucose into the cells. And in order for the glucose to get into the cells, it has to be attached to insulin. And then once it's in the cells, it will get converted to ATP only in the presence of all the nutrients that are required, amino acids, some B vitamins, and some minerals, and some antioxidants like CoQ10. Let's look at fructose. Fructose is another matter, and it's quite interesting to study. And I'm giving you an overview, and I'm giving you also links to where you can find out more. And you will find out on the page where this video is housed or on another page in the website. You'll actually see some references. Actually, it's probably on the resources page. And you'll see some references to a lot more detail that you can learn about fructose. So, first of all, fructose doesn't require insulin. But really, only tiny amounts of fructose circulate in the blood. Fructose doesn't actually get into the blood in any great amount. The transporter that it requires is called GLUT5, and that's what is required to get it into the cells. So it doesn't need insulin, but it needs this other transporter called GLUT5. For the most part, the fructose goes to the liver. That's where the majority of the fructose goes to and is metabolized. And once it gets there, it's considered a good way to store energy. So it's converted to triglycerides in the liver. So very little of the fructose that we eat actually gets converted into energy directly. Usually it gets converted into triglycerides in the liver. And it's stored as fat, and then it can be called upon later to be burned, but it's burned as a fat rather than as fructose. The problem is that consumption of high fructose meals can actually decrease the insulin and leptin concentration, which is not good, right? Because we're trying to help the glucose that usually comes along with the fructose to get into the cells. So if high fructose meals, it can decrease the level of insulin, then what we're going to have is that we're not going to be able to get the glucose into the cells. And the leptin as well. Leptin will tell the body that we're satiated. So high consumption of fructose actually leads to increase of hunger and sugar cravings. So fructose actually, of course, because it gets converted in the liver to triglycerides, will actually increase the blood levels of triglycerides. Another downside of fructose is that it does not suppress ghrelin. So you combine the fact that it affects the leptin concentrations, doesn't suppress ghrelin, which is a hormone that gets secreted by the stomach to signal that we're hungry, then it doesn't turn off the appetite. So you could get this ghrelin signal. You can be hungry. You can then have something that it contains fructose or high fructose corn syrup and still be hungry. And I'm sure you hear that a lot. I do too, from my clients. The other thing is that the hepatic metabolism of fructose favors lipogenesis. What does that mean? It means that the metabolism of fructose in the liver favors, causes the production of fat versus the burning of the fructose as fuel, or the storage of the fructose as glycogen. So that's not fun. We don't really want to be advising our clients to do things that cause an increase in fat production. The other thing is related to cardiovascular health, and fructose in significant quantities is correlated with smaller LDL particle size, which leads to increased cardiovascular risk. Well, what does that mean? Well, you know that we have HDLs and LDLs, and LDLs are low density lipoproteins, which means that there's not very much protein and a lot of fat. The smaller those particles are, the more concentrated they are in fat and the higher the cardiovascular disease risk. So believe it or not, high fructose consumption has been correlated with smaller LDLs particle size and thus increases cardiovascular risk. So there's a lot of research out there that points to the fact that it's sugar consumption, and in particular high fructose corn syrup and fructose consumption, that increases cardiovascular risk even more than many fats. Quite interesting. And there's so much of a push for fructose, high fructose corn syrup, and even the things that don't say high fructose corn syrup, that say fructose, it's still isolated fructose. It acts differently when you take it in as fruit, as long as you take it in as the whole fresh fruit, because there's fiber in there and there's other nutrients that help with this process. But still, a lot of people who are fructose sensitive can't even do too much in the way of fruit sugar. So the fructose from added sugar also increases plasma uric acid. And uric acid can contribute to kidney stones, and it can also contribute to gout. When the uric acid crystals get deposited in the joints, then it increases the probability of developing gout, and certainly painful. It also contributes to advanced glycation end products. What are these? They're also called AGEs, advanced glycation end products. These are basically sugar-coated molecules in the body. The sugar latches on to various proteins in the body, and we end up with these dangerous molecules, formations that can damage, that can cause oxidation, that can cause all sorts of problems. So we want to avoid that. It can also change the metabolic hormone response, and that can contribute to decreased satiety. We already mentioned that a little bit in terms of leptin and its effect on the ghrelin and not turning that off. And what you'll find, you just even experiment with yourself if you still do eat fructose, is to see how you feel after eating a certain amount of calories from fructose versus the same amount of calories from something like a handful of nuts or, you know, a salad with the nice dressing. It's highly lipogenic when consumed in high quantities, and it's moderately lipogenic when consumed in moderate quantities, and it's slightly lipogenic when consumed in low quantities. So what does that all mean? Well, lipogenic, it means it contributes to the genesis or the creation of fat, lipofat. So basically, it gives back to, helps to form more triglycerides and stores fat. So the same number of calories as fructose compared to the same number of calories, say, as coconut, you're going to find that the fructose is more likely to contribute to increased fat than would be the coconut, which is kind of the opposite of what a lot of folks believe. You know, they believe fat causes fat, but actually sugar creates fat, for the most part. The other piece about fructose is it can contribute to insulin resistance in the liver, which means that you're going to get chronically elevated insulin levels, blood sugar levels, because why? Well, if the cells in the liver are even insensitive to insulin, then you're not even going to get the sugar in the blood to be able to be stored in the liver as glycogen, which is going to lead to elevated blood sugars, which increases the risks, all the risks associated with diabetes. Can also cause an increase in the cholesterol levels as well as the triglycerides, as we've already talked about. So fructose is not really friendly. And people think, oh, fructose, it's fruit sugar, so it's okay. Well, yeah, it's okay if it's part of the whole package the way that nature intended it to be. But if you're pulling it out and away from the package, it's problematic. The reason it's okay in the fruits, as long as it's not in excessive amounts, is that fruits have lots of water and fiber, and they tend to have a low energy density compared to the quantity and the filling capacity. So it takes a while to chew them, and it's really hard to overeat fructose by eating fruit because the fiber and the water fill you up. However, if you juice the fruit, it's very easy to get excessive amounts of fructose. So we're talking eating whole fresh fruit because it's going to be self-limiting. Some people have to avoid the whole fresh fruits, especially the high glycemics, while they're in the throes of trying to restore insulin sensitivity. But on a whole, people should be eating fruit and a decent amount of fruit and whatever the body allows. When people add fruit to the diet, a lot of times it increases their caloric intake elsewhere because you're full, you're too full to eat anything else. So try it sometime. Try eating, 200 calories worth of fresh fruit, and then try drinking 200 calories worth of fruit juice or dried fruit or a snack that's sweetened with fructose. And you will find that you are way fuller when eating the fresh fruit for the most part. So while fructose from added sugars is bad, it does not have the same effect if it's from real foods like fruits. This chart is from Wikipedia, and it's actually a chart to help you look at various fruits and vegetables, their total carbohydrate content, and that includes the fiber, their total sugar content, and how much of that is fructose, glucose, or sucrose. And it's kind of telling. You can see, are there specific fruits that are higher in fructose than others? Well, figs, dried figs, 22.9 grams of fructose in 100 grams. So it's 100 grams of figs compared to 100 grams of bananas has 22 versus 4.9 fructose. Okay, what comes close to the dried fruits in fructose content? Nothing. Okay, apple's probably the closest. When we look at the total sugar content of figs, it's 47.9 in 100 grams versus, say, what's the lowest here? The lowest in terms of the fruit then would be something like an orange. They don't have berries up here, but you get the idea. And then in terms of vegetables, some vegetables still have some fructose, and they still have some sugar in them, but it's much, much lower. So beets and carrots obviously are highest. Corn, which isn't really a vegetable, it's a starch. And then sweet red pepper has a substantial amount. Onion, surprisingly, onion has more than a sweet potato, but the quantity that you normally would eat of an onion is much less than you would a sweet potato. Okay, so that's just for reference, just for curiosity, just for fun. And also for when people are asking you about specific foods, you can give them an answer. So galactose is milk sugar, and it comes from the breakdown of lactose. Lactose is a combination of galactose and glucose bonded together. In order to be able to break that bond apart, we need to have an enzyme called lactase. And I'm sure you've heard of lactase. Just about everybody's heard of lactase because lactase is deficient in a lot of folks, most folks actually, after the age of four, after the age of weaning. So when people don't have enough of the lactase, they can't break apart the lactose into galactose and glucose, which means that those sugars can't get absorbed through the intestinal lining and into the bloodstream, and they get pushed down further through the intestinal tract, and they cause a lot of gas and bloating as our intestinal bacteria start to break them down. It can be converted to glucose via glucose-6-phosphate, and there's a reference that shows those charts in that metabolic process. It's quite complicated. There are some studies that show a correlation with ovarian cancer. There are others that don't, so the jury is out on that one. But since ovarian cancer is pretty serious, my recommendation is until it's proven not to have a correlation with ovarian cancer beyond just a shadow of a doubt, I would be really, really cautious about it. And certainly let your patients, clients know who have a tendency towards those kinds of conditions, towards hormonally related cancers or are at high risk for other reasons, to really be careful, and I just recommend that they get off of dairy altogether. This is an interesting thing that I came across in my research, is that galactose is actually a component within the blood typing system, the ABO blood typing. So whereas A and O have two galactose molecules, there are three in the B type blood types. Just a little interesting tidbit of information. Not sure what that can be used for clinically, but I'm sure something might come up, and it's just nice to know. There's also another interesting tidbit. There's something called alpha-1-3 galactose, also called alpha-gal for short. It's been seen as a delayed allergy to mammal meat. So people who have high levels of this alpha-1-3 galactose actually have delayed hypersensitivities to mammal meat, you know, meaning what? Pork and beef and all those sorts of things. Oligosaccharides are actually monosaccharides chained together, and there's anywhere from 3 all the way up to maybe 9 of these. Once it goes above 9, they're starting to be considered polysaccharides. One of the oligosaccharides that you may have heard of is called fructooligosaccharides, and fructooligosaccharides have gotten a lot of press and a lot of research because of their ability to provide fuel for our intestinal bacteria, the good guys that we want to grow, without actually providing fuel for us. So if you were to take in this chain of fructose molecules, it's usually one glucose combined with any number of fructoses. So it could be a glucose at the top, a fructose at the bottom, and then any number up until somewhere around 7 of these fructoses in the middle. So it's a glucose head with a string of fructoses behind it, and they're different numbers. So the different fructooligosaccharides have different numbers. And when you take that in, it doesn't provide calories because we actually can't break it down. We don't have the enzymatic machinery to break those bonds, so it passes through the intestinal tract intact and provides fuel for our intestinal bacteria that do. Amylose is one of these oligosaccharides, and amylose is basically 3 glucoses or 3 or more glucoses strung together. So then when you string amyloses together, you get a longer chain, which is a fiber called amylopectin. So we talk a lot about sugar, and sugar, like I said, gets a bad rap. It's like, do we need it? There are some people who say, no, we don't need carbohydrates. We just need protein and fat in the diet. But in fact, studies are showing that we do need it. We need the sugars. First of all, there are parts of the brain that only run on glucose. They have a hard time running efficiently on ketones. So they have to have a little bit of sugar. But in general, there's a lot of reasons why you need sugar on a regular basis. I don't mean like you sit and eat table sugar. I mean foods that break down into a little bit of sugar. So let's just go into the details of why we need sugar. The main reason we need sugar, we need glucose in our bloodstream, is for energy. That's it. That's why we need it. So for people to say we don't need it, it's crazy. It's a lack of understanding. We need sugar in the bloodstream. We need to have glucose circulating, and it needs to be at a certain level in order for us to feel okay and have the energy we need to do all these functions. So the range that you're going to see when you look at blood work, if you look at somebody's fasting blood work, it's generally glucose in the neighborhood of, 75 to 85. It can go a little lower than that and still be just fine, like 65. Higher than that, though, you start to get into trouble and you start to get into more of a pre-insulin resistance. And we'll talk more about that in our blood sugar program. Sugar is important for energy. Why do we need that energy? Well, we need optimal cellular growth and repair. If you're not making enough energy, you're going to see dry, flaky skin. You're going to see wounds that don't heal. You're going to see very slow response to hair growth and nail growth. And you're just going to see some changes if you don't have the energy at a cellular level. You also need the energy for organ and gland function. So when you see people that have sluggish adrenal function or sluggish thyroid function or sluggish digestion, it could be a matter of not getting the right amount of sugar and ATP processed in the system. Of course, we need sugar for mental clarity and attention. We need energy to provide mental clarity, to be able to think things through, to be able to access the wizard brain and get out of the lizard brain, and to be able to focus. Energy is super important for steady moods. People who have sugar ups and downs will tend to be irritable and grouchy, and there's all sorts of things that are just not fun when we're in the state of low sugar or fluctuating sugar, up, down, up, down. Irritable, cranky, depressed, anxious. You need energy to have fun. And you really need to be emphasizing that with your clients, that having fun is a really important part of their health picture. I mean good, clean fun. I mean, don't mean fun that's going to get them in a state of biochemical disarray, like going out for pizza and beer or smoking cigarettes or doing recreational drugs. That may appear to be fun at the time, but in the long run, it's damaging. I'm talking about good fun, like going out for walks and going and checking out wildlife and flowers and doing puzzles and doing artwork and going to amusement parks and travel and going to the beach. I mean, fun, really good fun that's going to contribute to health. We need energy for meaningful relationships. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you're in a relationship, but you're exhausted or they're exhausted. It's not fun when you can't really connect with each other and have good times. And then finally, for achieving success in your chosen career. You're here because your chosen career is to help people overcome health challenges and get well. And in order for you to do that well, you need to have the right amount of sugar into in your system and the right processing of that sugar into ATP. So let's look at the best sources and the least desirable sources of sugar in our diet. On the less desirable side, we have the most common, which is table sugar or sucrose. I remember growing up with that sugar bowl on the table. We have fructose in the form of high fructose corn syrup and also just fractionated isolated fructose that's added to things. We have glucose syrup, and you don't see that a lot. You see that more in Europe, and it's actually metabolized more easily by the body than the combination of sucrose and fructose that we have here. Glucose is just able to be taken right in, requires very little processing. High fructose corn syrup, which has become the bane of our society, and it's just over the last few decades that the manufacturers have really brainwashed people into thinking, well, it's from corn, well, it's got fructose, which comes in fruit, therefore it must be a good healthy sweetener. And people are becoming aware that it's not. Maple syrup, you know, people think, wow, it's maple syrup, it comes straight from the tree, it's still got some B vitamins in it, but it is a source of simple sugar, and it's especially problematic for folks who don't have really good blood sugar regulation capacities. These are a couple of other refined sugars that are relatively new on the market in the last probably 10 years or so. Agave, coconut nectar, and palm sugar. And they've been all raved about as being sugars that don't raise the blood sugar that much and that keep things nice and steady. But in reality, they're simple sugars. And they may be slightly better than fructose and sucrose, but they're still problematic, and I've done lots of blood sugar testing with people, and there are quite a number of people whose blood sugars go up when they consume these kinds of sugars. Honey's another one. I mean, it's been around forever. It's been considered a health food forever. But again, it is a simple sugar in that it gets in there right away. It's very easy to absorb, very quick to be absorbed. So again, even if it has a little bit of nutrients, that may not be enough to really metabolize it well in some folks. And finally, refined grains. People think, well, what do you mean grains are sugar? How could grains be sugar? They're grains. They're starches. Well, they get converted so quickly into sugar that if you're eating a piece of white bread or some white pasta or anything like that, it's just going to be cause a really big sugar spike in the body. Let's look at the best sources of sugar. Believe it or not, green leafy vegetables. They actually have some sugar and some carbs. And that chart that I showed you earlier, you'll see that. Not a lot, but that's the beauty of them, is that they provide small amounts of glucose and sucrose and fructose with very low concentration of calories because of how much fiber and water and minerals are in them. So that's your absolutely best source of carbohydrate or sugars. Rainbow-colored vegetables, a little bit higher in the sugar content. For example, beets and carrots and red bell peppers. If you look at the chart, you'll see slightly higher levels of sugars in there. But again, they're complex with very, very good fiber structure and lots of water, which helps them to get used much more slowly. So the next source of sugar that's more of a complex, which means it takes longer to break it down and digest and get into the sugar, which means it gives you a nice, steady, slow uptake of sugar into the system. For most people, there are some people who it's much quicker for, are the root vegetables and tubers. Those would be things like your winter squashes, beets and carrots again, sweet potatoes and yams, and potatoes. White potatoes tend to be a higher, even though they're complex, they still tend in studies to show that they raise the blood sugar much more quickly than other tubers. Then we've got fruit, bananas, apples, pears, blueberries, and they're all different in how much sugar they contain and how quickly they'll raise your blood sugar. And it's very independent, and when we look at the blood sugar balancing part of the course, you're going to see that there's ways for you to actually measure and figure out for each person which fruits work really well and which fruits actually are being absorbed too quickly. Whole non-gluten grains. So I'm talking whole here. I'm not talking flour products. I'm not talking pasta, bread, crackers made with whole grains. No, I'm talking the whole grains. So millet and quinoa and brown rice and buckwheat and teff and amaranth. Those are whole non-gluten grains. And when you slow simmer them and keep them intact and don't break them apart, the sugars are absorbed much more slowly. Same thing with legumes. They have small amounts of sugars. In fact, some of those carbohydrates in the legumes are what gives the notorious tooting syndrome, the gas that comes with the legumes, because there are particular sugars in there that our bodies have a difficult time breaking down. Nuts and seeds, they have a little bit, not a whole lot, and some more than others, but they will have a little bit of sugars in them. Those are the healthy ones. So let's now talk about getting the sugar into the cells. We've talked briefly about insulin, and you'll hear about insulin over and over and over again when we get to our blood sugar balancing module. But it requires enough insulin, so you need to have a pancreas that can produce enough insulin. And some of the things that can thwart the pancreas from producing enough insulin are inflammatory conditions and autoimmune. So it's actually possible to be making antibodies to the pancreas, the islet cells in the pancreas that make the insulin. It's also possible for making enough insulin but having that be attacked because a lot of folks have anti-insulin antibodies. You're going to see more of these in the cases of type 1 diabetes or people that are heading towards type 1 diabetes. The second thing we need to get sugar into the cells and working for you is, guess what? Healthy insulin receptors. So you can produce all the insulin in the world, but if the receptors have closed their ears to the signal, to the sounds of insulin tapping on their doors, then it's not going to get in and the sugar's not going to get in. And then finally, we need nutrients. There's nutrients that are required to support the transport of the insulin attached to the sugar and get it into the cells. So some of those nutrients are things like your B vitamins and things like chromium, magnesium, and even the essential fat, or the non-essential fat, but the omega-3 fat, DHA. It's essential for body function, but not essential necessarily to have in the diet because the body can make it. So remember, we made that distinction between essential and non-essential when it comes to the macronutrients. So we need, in order to get the sugar into the cells so that they can be processed by ATP, we need insulin, we need healthy insulin receptors, we need a healthy immune system so it's not attacking, we need the nutrients. And the main nutrient that I find to be deficient in folks when they have difficulties with getting sugar into their cells is chromium. Chromium polynicotinate is the form that's been used most commonly. So let's take a look at how sugar is converted into energy. This is just a little bit of a review because we went over this in great detail in our cellular metabolism module. But this is basically the Krebs cycle. And you know that the sugars go into the cycle and it goes around and just gets converted, and there's a transfer of carbons and carbon dioxides are released, and there's just constant through the cycle until what comes out is ATP. So that's the Krebs cycle, and I highly recommend that you go back and study that if you're feeling unfamiliar with it at this point. So what are the negative effects of simple sugars? We hear it all the time. You've probably said it to your clients a number of times. You know, get rid of the sugars, get rid of the sugars. There's a lot of deleterious effects. So it's really important for you to be able to articulate those to your clients so that they're feeling empowered to do it, not just another rule. They understand what impact it's having on them. And when you can relate the negative effects of the sugar to them, to their life, to their goals, to what you know is important to them, it's going to be much more likely to be effective in helping them to get off of it and stay off of it. What I find with sugar is that folks they're addicted to it, and they're addicted to it on a physiologic basis. They're also addicted to it on an emotional basis. It's comfort. So some of the things that have to happen when you're having the conversation about sugar with someone is to really, you get to ask the right questions to understand, what is their connection with the sugar? Is it that they need it to keep their energy up? Is it that they have poor blood sugar metabolism? They're up and down and they're getting cravings. Is it a hormonal imbalance? Is it a psychological connection to sugar as comfort? Because it's very commonly used as a comfort food. So let's have a look at some of these things. So first of all, one of the negative effects is blood sugar imbalance leading to insulin resistance and potentially diabetes. And what happens when people are taking in simple sugars, we know that it triggers the release of insulin from the pancreas, raises the insulin levels. The insulin does its job of putting the sugar into the cells. But over time, the cells become resistant for any number of reasons. One of the reasons is that insulin can be damaging to the cells. Insulin can cause a loss of elasticity to the cells. Insulin can cause a thickening of the cell membranes and a loss of the great transmittal function. So it's basically, it can cause problems. It can cause issues that the body's trying to protect itself from, so it naturally becomes insulin resistance. Plus the sugar, I mean, there's just so much sugar we need to have going into those cells at any point in time. And when we're bombarded with it, it's just too much and it overpowers the mechanisms and the ability of the body to convert it into energy. So the cells say enough, and then the sugar sits there. So when the cells say enough and it truly is enough, that's fine. But after a while, the cells start to say enough because we've used up all the nutrients that are needed for the transport, like the chromium and magnesium and DHA and CoQ10 and a lot of others. And the body just gets, it's done, right? And then when you get this insulin resistance over time, the sugars stay high, and then the body has to deal with the negative effects of elevated sugars, which is the glycosylation of hemoglobin and the kind of thickening and stickiness of the blood cells, and eventually can cause damage to peripheral arteries, peripheral nerves, etc. So we really want to help people to maintain blood sugar, and that is done quite simply by taking, once they've developed insulin resistance, is taking away all the sources of sugar for a good period of, say, 3 to 4 weeks, and then allowing those receptors to reset. Another obvious one, mom told you that when you were a kid, don't eat too much sugar, you're going to get dental cavities. And indeed, the sugar feeds the bacteria in the mouth, the very acidic forming bacteria in the mouth, which causes plaque on the teeth, which starts to decay the teeth. So that's an obvious one. Everybody knows that one. Decreased immunity is one that a lot of folks don't get. And what happens when you take in a dose of sugar, it causes a decrease in the white blood cells called macrophages, which are basically the Pac-Man of the body. They go around and gobble up bacteria and viruses and things that are no good for us. And when you have an influx of simple sugar, those macrophages go down significantly. And there are a lot of studies that talk about this. Specifically, I've seen anywhere from the range of they go down by 50% for a period of 2 hours with a dose that's equivalent to a teaspoon or two of sugar, all the way up to, say, a 90% decrease in their effectiveness for 6 to 8 hours after something like drinking a Coca-Cola, so which is about 6 or 8 teaspoons of sugar, a lot of sugar. The other thing is that it accelerates cancer cells. Cancer cells have extra insulin receptors on their membranes, and they don't get resistant. Cancer cells thrive on keeping themselves alive, and they want to gobble up all the nutrients out of the body. So they will gobble up the sugars because they've got the little flags on them, the insulin receptors saying, feed me, feed me. And likely the regular cells have the resistance and they're not accepting the sugar. So sugar will accelerate the growth of cancer. And on many anti-cancer programs in the natural health community, nutrition community, all sugars, including fruits, are taken away during the treatment of cancer. Not to say that fruit causes cancer. By no stretch can we say that. But once cancer has developed in an unhealthy body, the presence of fruit can accelerate its growth. Sugar can cause premature aging, and that's from a lot of that glycosylation that happens from the excess sugar in the system. And we find that people's skin loses its elasticity, the collagen gets less plump, and we age prematurely. Another thing, and a lot of these are documented in a really nice book called Sugar Shock, and these are just a lot of documented studies from the medical literature talk about the hostility and aggressiveness that happens when people are on sugars. It affects the brain chemistry. And what happens is there's a brain chemical called serotonin. It's a neurotransmitter. And sugar actually increases levels of serotonin temporarily, very temporarily, because once the effect of the sugar wears off, those levels drop down and cause you get cranky and irritable because of the up, down of the serotonin levels. So very important to stay away from it. There have also been some studies that show that there's a decreased libido with the intake of sugar, that people lose interest. And some explanations were as simple as, well, they are getting more satisfaction from the sugar than they are from sex or from their partner. All the way to creating hormonal imbalances and immune system imbalances and all that. So definitely an issue. It's also been linked with Alzheimer's. Recently, over the last few years, Alzheimer's has been starting to be referred to as insulin resistance of the brain, or type 3 diabetes. And in fact, there's insulin receptors that become resistant on some of the cells in the brain that are responsible for short-term memory. And one of those things that it can lead to is actually Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's is not fun. And when you're talking to your clients and explaining to them the downside of sugar, you know, ask them if they've had any relatives who've started to lose their mind, who gotten Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia. It's not fun, and I don't think it's anything anybody would want to look forward to. And if there's things that they can do now to prevent that decline later, all the more reason to do it. So let's look at a few other things. Well, it certainly depletes B vitamins and other nutrients required for energy production. Think about this. When you eat foods in a whole form, you're getting the full package. You're getting sugars, you're getting proteins, you're getting fats, you're getting B vitamins and minerals. And those things are required for the Krebs cycle to take the sugar and make it usable. And so if you're eating sugar without the complete package, it's going to have to find those nutrients in the body. And at first it may be able to, at the risk of other functioning being lost. But after a while, what's going to happen is the B vitamins are depleted, the minerals are depleted, and you're unable to actually make energy from this sugar that comes in. And that might be part of the mechanism of the cells shutting down, is don't let any more sugar in because we can't process it. The other thing it can cause is intestinal distress, right? You've heard of Candida albicans overgrowth and fungal overgrowths in the gut. A number of bacteria that are not our friends grow in the gut, and it can cause problems. Another thing that some of these sugars actually start to ferment in the gut. And part of it is we lose the ability to break down the disaccharides into monosaccharides for absorption. We lose the lactase, the sucrase, the maltase. And what happens is it causes bloating and gas as the bacteria and the organisms in the gut have a field day. And Candida overgrowth is part of that, the intestinal distress. Candida, they love sugar. And when you feed them sugar, they thrive, they grow out of control, and they overpower the good bacteria that your body needs to produce B vitamins, to digest food, to keep that nice, friendly balance in your gut. Mood swings and depression are very, very common with sugar. There's the ups and the downs. There's a lot of times it's the downside. It's when someone is on the sugar, when they eat the sugar, they're feeling phenomenal. But it doesn't last. And it's the dip that causes them to then go back and crave the sugar again. So mood swings and depression are very commonly associated with the intake of simple sugars. Of course, there's addiction. You know, you hear people all the time, they just have to have their fix. I was visiting someone once, and she was out, she was going to be home late, and she said another friend was coming over for the evening, and her friend might get there before her. And I said, okay, so I was in the kitchen, and I was sitting there doing some computer work or whatever, and she came in and started talking. She goes, do you have anything sweet to eat? I'm like, well, no, not really. I don't eat sweets. Well, I wonder if she has any sweets. I wonder if there's any sweets. Do you know where she might keep her sweets? I'm like, well, there's a drawer over there that has some stuff in it. She goes, I just need something sweet. And she looked around, and she didn't see anything, and she saw nuts. And I said, well, I have some, I don't know what I had. I had something that might have been stevia sweetened or something. No, I need sugar. And she was like desperate for something sweet. And I was just watching this in amazement. It becomes just obsessive. And I'm sure you've either felt that way at times or seen people feeling that way at times. The other thing that sugars do is they contribute to inflammation. They contribute to imbalances in the pathways where fatty acids are processed to create anti-inflammatory prostaglandins. And if you're unfamiliar with that process, make sure you go back and review the inflammatory pathways in the fat module. But you'll see that sugar is very key in there, in that it depletes the B vitamins, it depletes the minerals and all that's needed to control inflammation. And sugars lead. And there's so much more. And if you want to go into more depth, Chapter 4 of the textbook, The Nutrition and Biochemistry, and it has some good information. But I recommend the Sugar Shock book by Connie Bennett. Very interesting stuff, but it's backed up. So you can actually go from there to look at the science if you're the kind that likes to do that. So how do we assess a person's tolerance to various sugars? We have a whole big module on this in the blood sugar balancing program part of this, but we have ways to home test. So I'll give you an overview, and you'll learn way more when you go in there with charts and what it should be and all that. But home testing is phenomenal. A lot of people will, when they suspect they have hypoglycemia, they go to the doctor and the doctor says, well, let's do a glucose tolerance test. And they have to go to the office and they have to drink this yucky syrup and they measure how high the sugar goes. And it's an artificial, contrived situation. And I certainly understand the value of seeing how does your body respond under the worst circumstance of taking like 50 or 100 grams of pure sugar. And what does your body do? In an ideal world where the body's really well balanced, it doesn't do much of anything. The sugar may start at 85, go up to 108, and then come back down to 85 within 2 hours. That's what a good, healthy person would be. The majority of people who do these glucose tolerance tests, however, are not healthy people. And when you give them a test like that, it just causes so much distress because they may have already given up those kind of foods. They're just struggling to find out what's going on with them. So I don't like doing that with people. What I like doing is teaching them how to do a glucose tolerance test at their own home using the foods that they normally eat. So I'll have them pick the worst meal that they ever eat, like the highest carbohydrate meal. And if they're just somebody that's new and they're coming off the standard American diet, that might just be, you know, croissants and sweet tea and other things like that. But for a lot of folks, it's not. They've already given up that stuff, but they're still doing things like fruit juice, or they're still eating, blueberry yogurt, or other things like that. So I'll have them say, what's your highest carbohydrate meal? And we'll talk about what those might be. And then I'll tell them to have that meal first thing in the morning, and then give them a chart to track their glucose over the next few hours. And they can do it quite inexpensively at home. Whereas in the office, it might cost, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of several hundred dollars. At home, it's just a matter of spending 10 or 15 for the glucose meter. And then you probably would go through maybe a half a box of strips over the course of a day, which would be another $10. So for somewhere in the $20 to $25 range, you do it at home in the comfort of your own home. You're tracking your own sugar. You're charting it and finding out how that worst meal affects you. Once you've figured out how that worst meal affects you, I have them do it for a variety of foods. I'll have them check for the foods that we want them to start eating, foods that they already eat that may be questionable, and some of the foods that we don't suspect are going to cause a problem. So we can get a repertoire of foods and then teach them how to eat for blood sugar balance, which we'll go through in great detail in the blood sugar balancing part of the program. In addition to home testing for glucose tolerance, and you can do it in many different ways, which we go into great detail on later, but lab testing can be done. And there's a number of different lab tests that are really important for assessing blood glucose. Fasting blood glucose is actually one of the least... Fasting blood glucose is actually one of the least valuable because it just gives what that person's fasting is first thing in the morning when they get up. It doesn't tell us at all how they respond to food. And in fact, when we're heading on the continuum towards diabetes, the fasting blood glucose gets altered and is out of the normal range long after there's been a standing problem with glucose and a lot of damage that's been done. It's been said that every time the blood glucose goes above 120, there's some damage to the peripheral nerves, which leads to peripheral neuropathies, very common in diabetes. And the way that the standard medical approach is to look at diabetes is once the fasting blood sugar gets above 120, that person has diabetes. But if the fasting blood sugar gets above 120, it means that the non-fasting has been way above 120 for a long time, which means that that poor person, instead of being caught early and giving them the strategies to reverse it, they're going to be stuck with these damage to the peripheral nerves and to the retina and other parts of the body, kidneys, etc. So fasting blood glucose, not very valuable, especially if the person has their own meter, they could do it at home. But hemoglobin A1C measures the effect of glucose over the course of 3 months or 4 months. It actually looks at the red blood cells and sees how much of the hemoglobin is actually sugar-coated. That's what glycosylated hemoglobin is, what hemoglobin A1C is. And when there's a lot of sugar been in the bloodstream, the red blood cells naturally have some percentage of them are going to be sugar-coated. the normal, the average, the good amount that it should be is somewhere between 4.5 and 5%. When it starts to go above 5%, it indicates that there's an issue. And it's considered in the insulin resistant / diabetic range when it goes above 5.7. And frankly, it's kind of crazy, but for diabetics, it's considered under control if it gets down to 7, because diabetics, when they're diagnosed, are generally ranging in the hemoglobin A1C in 10 or 11 range. So they're trying to get them down to 7. But when you do the calculations, and we teach you how to do that in the other program, in the other part of the program, the blood sugar balancing, you'll see that the average blood glucose when the hemoglobin A1C is up in the 11s, it's somewhere in the 180, 200 range. And when it's at 5.7, the average blood glucose is somewhere in the 130 range. So you can see that we want the average blood glucose to be a lot lower than that. And I like it to be at least less than 100, because that takes into account not only the after dinner and after meals glucose, but the throughout the night when the person's fasting, and it should be low. So if you average that out and say they're overnight, they're in the 80s, and their average based on the hemoglobin A1C is in the 120s, that means a lot of the time they're way up higher than that. So that's scary. So we use that to measure long-term. We'll go through way more detail later, but I just want you to be familiar with these things so you can start looking at your clients, especially if they bring in lab testing that they've done through their practitioner. Fructosamine is similar to hemoglobin A1C. And what fructosamine is measuring is amino acids that are coated with fructose. So it's basically similar, but it shifts more quickly. With the hemoglobin A1C, the red blood cells last for about 120 days. So the hemoglobin A1C is going to give you the averages over that 120 days. So if you make some changes, or you get your client to make some changes, you can't really go back and test it in a month and see how well it's doing. You have to wait. You have to look at, of course, you can look at the glucose and be monitoring it throughout the day, but you can't see the effect on the hemoglobin A1C for 3 to 4 months. Whereas with fructosamine, you can check it once a month and see. Is it as accurate? The jury's out, and there's some controversy over whether it is, but I think it's actually a decent measure. And the last one on the lab testing that is going to give you some information about how people are handling sugars is, of course, their insulin level. I like to look at their fasting insulin level. I'd also like to look at what's called their postprandial insulin level, which means their insulin after meals. Fasting is a good way to get it, because if the person is becoming insulin resistant, you're going to see high levels of fasting blood sugar. I mean, if they're severely insulin resistant, actually become and cross over into insulin resistance. So when you see a high elevated fasting insulin, you know that that person's in an insulin resistance phase. And what is a good level? Well, I like to see it between 3 and 5. That's what a good level would be. When it gets way low, you start to suspect that their pancreas is no longer making enough insulin, and you've got to do some more deep testing. It might be a type 1 diabetes or a latent onset adult diabetes. And we'll talk more about that in blood sugar balancing. So those are basically the kinds of tests you can do to see if your client is handling sugars and to get some momentum behind your recommendation to them to go off of it if they need it. Some folks are just inspired to change, and they change, and it's not a problem. And other people need a little bit of something, a motivation. And when you can show them labs, or you can show them a specific test when they do it, it's going to be way more compelling for them. So now that we've talked about the structure of sugar, the role of sugar, the dangers of simple sugars, how to test for the sugar balance, we're going to look at how you can coach your clients on what are the best alternatives to sugar for satisfying a sweet tooth. Well, my top favorite is actually stevia. Why? Well, because it's a green plant. It actually, you can grow some in the yard, and it looks a little bit similar to mint, and it's quite lovely, and you can actually go out and eat the leaves, and fresh is best. You can also get dehydrated stevia, which is basically the leaves that have been dehydrated. That's the next one. After that, my next favorite would be sweet leaf concentrated stevia, and the reason for that is what they do is they take the whole fresh leaves and they basically boil them down into a concentrated, almost syrup-like consistency. So it's still got everything in it. It's starting with the fresh plant. The white stevias have been, all the coloring has been removed, the chlorophyll's been removed, it's just simply white, and oftentimes it's adulterated with other things like dextrose and rice flour. So be careful of those. These are the kinds of stevia I think fresh is best, so go get a plant and plant it. You probably can grow it in your kitchen, but I know you can grow it in your yard because we used to do that. Next would be the green powder. Brands, you know, some of the nice brands that sell herbs like Frontier Herbs and Mountain Rose Herbs, they all have a variety of their green stevia. And you try them out, try different ones and see what tastes best. And with the sweet leaf, they actually have a bunch of different flavored sweet leaf concentrates. So I've got coconut and cinnamon and chocolate and hazelnut and vanilla, all kinds of things like that. So awesome stuff. Another alternative to sugar would be a Chinese herb called lohan. And you got to be careful with lohan because there's a lot of companies that will make it, but they adulterate it with things like fructose and dextrose. So you want to get some pure lohan, and there are places that you can find it. I know Swanson has it, and there are a number of other places that have the pure lohan. It comes as a white powder. You can mix it. Mixes very well with stevia. It tends to take a little bit of the edge off of the bitterness that some people perceive with stevia. Another one is erythritol, which is in the family of sugar alcohols. And sugar alcohols they're not alcohol and they're not sugar. We'll look in more detail at the different kinds of sugar alcohols, and I have a chart where you can compare them. My favorite is erythritol, mainly because the erythritol does not get digested. It does not pass through into the lower bowel, the large intestine, like the other sugar alcohols, where they're subject to possible fermentation by bad gut bacteria and causing bloating and gas. So with erythritol, we're basically looking at it being absorbed further up in the small intestine, so it doesn't really pass through the rest of the intestinal tract. It has a zero calorie count and a zero glycemic index, whereas the others have a little bit more just because it's passing through and some of the sugars are actually getting absorbed. Chicory root, inulin. This is a new one. I've been trying to work on testing it. I've tested it a little bit and so far it looks good. It comes as either a powder, it's a brand called Just Like Sugar, or it comes as a syrup. And it works pretty well. It's similar to Jerusalem artichoke syrup, which is also high in inulin. And inulin, as you recall, is the long starch form of or fiber form of the fructooligosaccharide. So it's a string of fructooligosaccharides strung together. And when it breaks down, it actually can create good food for the gut, and it's not metabolized and it's not caloric for us. Yacon, you know, that's another one. It's like a tuber that grows in South America. It's been used for a while. For some people, it raises their blood sugar. For others, it doesn't. I think if you're going to do it, you're best off with either the whole slices or the powder, as opposed to the extracts, which tend to be heated and made into a syrup. And those, I think, if they're going to be a higher glycemic, would be. And it's really a matter of testing. You know, for anything. I know I've never seen anybody have blood sugar elevations from stevia, lohan, or erythritol, but it's certainly possible with things like chicory, yacon, and the Jerusalem artichoke. I don't have blood sugar elevations from Jerusalem artichoke. I haven't noticed it from the chicory root. I've tested a few times. Yacon, I haven't really tested. So let's look at particular products where you can send your clients to. What we have pictured here is one called Lakanto, and that's a combination of erythritol and lohan. We have Zero, which is organic erythritol. And then we have Just Like Sugar, which is the chicory root. So let's look more closely at sugar alcohols, what they are, what they do, how they are metabolized in the body. They're also known as polyols. And when we look at the FODMAPs diet, FODMAPs are the fermentable oligo and disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And that's what that stands for. And the idea is that some people do not digest any of the saccharides. They don't digest any of the sugars including the sugar alcohols and including some of the starches that break down into that, the oligosaccharides, etc. So you have people get off of those saccharides and see how they do, and we'll go more into that, and we do our digestion module. So polyols, they don't contain ethanol. In spite of them being called sugar alcohol, they don't. It's the OH groups on there that are chemically considered alcohol, and that's why it's considered sugar alcohol. So if you look at the picture, you'll see the difference between glucose and erythritol, and how the glucose can be converted into erythritol. And there's actually a process they can do in the lab that can convert glucose to erythritol. You can find erythritol in corn and birch. Same thing with xylitol, but they can also kind of do a fermentation process with glucose and turn it into erythritol. So the sweetness is very similar to sucrose. They have way fewer calories. In fact, erythritol has no calories. They're naturally occurring, like I said, and birch and corn. If you're going to get naturally occurring, I prefer that you go for the birch, because the corn is generally organic, is GMO. So erythritol from that's sold as zero is definitely non-GMO and it's organic. And then the theory is, and I mostly have found this to be true, that they don't raise blood sugar. It's possible that sorbitol or xylitol can actually raise it a little bit, because they do have a few calories and they do have a little bit of sugar, quote unquote, in there. So when the breakdown is not complete, but erythritol actually has none. So that's why that's my chosen one. And most people do not get digestive upset from erythritol. So here's a little chart comparing them. Erythritol is a 4-carbon. The others are mannitol and sorbitol are 6, and xylitol is 5. And compared with sucrose, so the second column is how sweet are they compared to sucrose. So erythritol is 80% as sweet as sucrose, whereas mannitol is only 50%, sorbitol 60%, but xylitol is actually equivalent in sweetness. But here's the thing, in terms of calories per gram, sucrose would have 4 calories per gram. Erythritol has 0.2, so it's just a tiny, tiny fraction of a calorie. Whereas mannitol is 1.6, sorbitol is 2.6, and xylitol is 2.4. So sorbitol and xylitol are actually pretty close. It's not that much less sweet. It's not that much less caloric. So it's kind of deceiving to think of them as sugar substitutes that are non-caloric. And then when you look at sweetness per food energy, so sweetness per calories relative to sucrose, so we have 15 times as much sweetness per calorie in erythritol, whereas only 1.6 as much in xylitol. And I point to the erythritol and xylitol because those are the ones that you're going to see most. Xylitol has a lot of studies on it based on its ability to help control dental cavities and just basically stop those buggers in your mouth from eating away at the teeth. I haven't seen those kind of studies on erythritol, and I haven't really looked very hard. It's possible that they're there, but xylitol is the one that's gotten the most studies, and we have a lot of dentists that are recommending that their patients chew xylitol gum after eating to get their mouth cleaned out. Now, if you want to gargle with a xylitol or rinse with a xylitol mouthwash and then spit it out, I think that would be ideal for cleaning the teeth. As far as chewing gum, I'm not a big fan of gum chewing just because it stimulates digestive juices, but on the other hand, if you are doing it right after a meal, it may not be a bad idea to stimulate digestive juices. So those are your sugar alcohols. And let's just look a little bit more detail at erythritol and why I think it's the best of the sugar alcohols. And these are the products you can get it in. Zero is 100%. There's another one called Smart Sweet. And then the Smart Sweet 4.5 pounds, you could see, the descriptions of it. So most of it is absorbed in the small intestine, and it's excreted unchanged in the urine and feces. So whatever goes through the intestine gets excreted unchanged, and whatever goes through the urine gets excreted unchanged. So basically, you borrow the sweetness and it passes right through. About 10% enters the colon, but normally it doesn't cause a laxative effect. Of course it could in someone who's super sensitive, so you've just got to be aware of that. It's generally free of side effects in regular use. Of course, in very high quantities, anything, even too much water, can be problematic. So doses over 50 grams. Like, who's going to have over 50 grams of this stuff in one sitting? 1.8 ounces can cause some nausea and stomach rumbling. It's more difficult for the intestinal bacteria to digest than other bacteria, so it's less likely to cause gas or bloating. Maybe because it's a 4-carbon, I don't know, but it generally, that's what the studies have shown. It's naturally occurring in things like pears and melons and grapes, mushrooms, wine, soy sauce, and cheese. So that's kind of interesting. That may be what gives part of the sweetness to those things. And finally, we've gone over a lot here, and there's a lot more to know. And this might be a topic that you just want to dig deeper into. So in the Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism textbook that I recommended for the course, Chapter 4, there's a really good handling of the biochemistry of sugar. And Sugar Shock by Connie Bennett I thought was a really good. There's also Sugar Blues, and there's a number of others, and I've listed those in your reference guide. But some of the statistics I pulled out about the depression and the mood swings and all that came from Sugar Shock. So thank you very much. This is Dr. Rita Marie, and we'll see you on the next video.